grasp the importance of the secret things that he and Ryan knew. But there was no way he could even approach discussing that sort of thing with anyone without a TS-SAR clearance. And that included his wife, just as it included Kathy Ryan. Hmm, Jackson thought. Maybe that was something he should discuss with Jack. You had to be able to talk this stuff over with someone you trusted, just as a reality check on what was right and wrong. Their wives weren't security risks, were they? Like what? His father asked, only halfway expecting an answer. Like I can't discuss some things with you, Pap, and you know that. I'm sorry, the rules apply to me just like they do to everybody else. So what are we going to do about this? We're going to let the Chinese know that we are pretty damned angry, and we expect them to clean their act up and apologize, and— Apologize? Reverend Jackson shot back. Robert, they murdered two people. I know that, Pap, but we can't send the FBI over to arrest their government for this, can we? We are very powerful here, but we are not God, and as much as I'd like to hurl a thunderbolt at them, I can't. So we are going to do what? We haven't decided yet. I'll let you know when we figure it out, Tomcat promised his father. Do that, Hosiah said, hanging up far more abruptly than usual. Christ, Pap, Robbie breathed into the phone. Then he wondered how representative of the religious community his father was. The hardest thing to figure was public reaction. People reacted on a sub-intellectual level to what they saw on TV. If you showed some chief of state tossing a puppy dog out the window of his car, the ASPCA might demand a break in diplomatic relations, and enough people might agree to send a million telegrams or emails to the White House. Jackson remembered a case in California where the killing of a dog had caused more public outrage than the kidnap murder of a little girl. But at least the bastard who'd killed the girl had been caught, tried, and sentenced to death, whereas the asshole who'd tossed the little dog into traffic had never been identified, despite the ton of reward money that had been raised. Well, it had all happened in the San Francisco area. Maybe that explained it. America wasn't supposed to make policy on the basis of emotion. But America was a democracy, and therefore her elected officials had to pay attention to what the people thought. And it wasn't easy, especially for rational folk, to predict the emotions of the public at large. Could the television image they'd just seen theoretically upset international trade? Without a doubt. And that was a very big deal. Jackson got up from his desk and walked to Arnie's office. "Got a question," he said, going in. "Shoot," the president's chief of staff replied. "How's the public going to react to this mess in Beijing?" "Not sure yet," Van Damme answered. "How do we find out?" "Usually you just wait and see. I'm not into this focus group stuff. I prefer to gauge public opinion the regular way. Newspaper editorials, letters to the editor, and the mail we get here. You're worried about this?" "Yep," Robbie nodded. "Yeah, so am I. The right-to-lifers are going to be on this like a lion on a crippled gazelle, and so are the people who don't like the PRC. Lots of them in Congress. If the Chinese think they're going to get MFN this year, they're on drugs. It's a public relations nightmare for the PRC, but I don't think they're capable of understanding what they started. And I don't see them apologizing to anybody." "Yeah, well, my father just tore me a new asshole over this one," Vice President Jackson said. "If the rest of the clergy picks this one up, there's going to be a firestorm. The Chinese have to apologize loud and fast if they want to cut their losses." Van Damme nodded agreement. "Yeah, but they won't. They're too damn proud." "Pride goeth before the fall," Tomcat observed. "Only after you feel the pain from the broken ass bone, Admiral," Van Damme corrected the Vice President. Ryan entered the White House press room feeling tense. The usual cameras were there. CNN and Fox would probably be running this news conference live, and maybe C-SPAN as well. The other networks would just tape it, probably, for use in their news feeds to the local stations and their own flagship evening news shows. He came to the lectern and took a sip of water before staring into the faces of the assembled 30 or so spectators. "Good morning," Jack began, grasping the lectern tightly, as he tended to do when angry. He didn't know that reporters knew about it, too, and could see it from where they sat. "We all saw those horrible pictures on the television this morning. The deaths of Renato Cardinal de Milo, the Papal Nuncio to the People's Republic of China, and the Reverend Yufa An, who we believe was a native of the Republic of China and educated at Oral Roberts University in Oklahoma. First of all, the United States of America extends our condolences to the families of both men. Second, we call upon the government of the People's Republic to launch an immediate and full investigation of this horrible tragedy, to determine who, if anyone, was at fault, and if someone was at fault, for such person or persons to be prosecuted to the full extent of the law. The death of a diplomat at the hands of an agent of a government is a gross violation of international treaty and convention. It is a quintessentially uncivilized act that must be set right as quickly and definitively as possible. Peaceful relations between nations cannot exist without diplomacy, and diplomacy cannot be carried out except through men and women whose personal safety is sacrosanct. That has been the case for literally thousands of years. Even in time of war, the lives of diplomats have always been protected by all sides for this very reason. We require that the government of the PRC explain this tragic event and take proper action to see to it that nothing of this sort will ever happen again. That concludes my statement. Questions? Ryan looked up, trying not to brace too obviously for the storm that was about to break. "Mr. President," the Associated Press said, "the two clergymen who died were there to prevent an abortion. Does that affect your reaction to this incident?" Ryan allowed himself to show surprise at the stupid question. "My views on abortion are on public record, but I think everyone, even the pro-choice community, would respond negatively to what happened here. The woman in question did not choose to have an abortion, but the Chinese government tried to impose its will on her by killing a full-term fetus about to be born. If anyone did that in the United States, that person would be guilty of a felony. Probably more than one. Yet that is government policy in the People's Republic. As you know, I personally object to abortion on moral grounds. But what we saw attempted on TV this morning is worse even than that. It's an act of incomprehensible barbarism. Those two courageous men tried to stop it, and they were killed for their efforts. But thank God the baby appears to have survived. Next question." Ryan pointed next to a known troublemaker. "Mr. President," the Boston Globe said, "the government's action grew out of the People's Republic's population control policy. Is it our place to criticize a country's internal policy?" Christ, Ryan thought, another one? "You know, once upon a time, a fellow named Hitler tried to manage the population of his country, in fact, of a lot of Europe, by killing the mentally infirm, the socially undesirable, and those whose religions he didn't like. Now, yes, Germany was a nation-state, and we even had diplomatic relations with Hitler until December 1941. But are you saying that America does not have the right to object to a policy we consider barbaric just because it is the official policy of a nation-state? Hermann Göring tried that defense at the Nuremberg trials. Do you want the United States of America to recognize it?" Jack demanded. The reporter wasn't as used to answering questions as to asking them. Then she saw that the cameras were pointed her way, and she was having a bad hair day. Her response, therefore, could have been a little better. "Mr. President, is it possible that your views of abortion have affected your reaction to this event?" "No, ma'am. I've disapproved of murder even longer than I've objected to abortion," Ryan replied coldly. "But you've just compared the People's Republic of China to Hitler's Germany," the Globe reporter pointed out. "You can't say that about them." Both countries shared a view of population control that is antithetical to American traditions. Or do you approve of imposing late-term abortions on women who choose not to have one? Sir, I'm not the president, the Globe replied as she sat down, avoiding the question, but not the embarrassed blush. Mr. President, began the San Francisco Examiner, whether we like it or not, China has decided for itself what sort of laws it wants to have, and the two men who died this morning were interfering with those laws, weren't they? The Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King interfered with the laws of Mississippi and Alabama back when I was in high school. Did the examiner object to his actions then? Well, no, but we regard the personal human conscience as a sovereign force, don't we? Jack shot back. The principle goes back to St. Augustine, when he said that an unjust law is no law. Now, you guys in the media agree with that principle. Is it only when you happen to agree with the person operating on that principle? Isn't that intellectually dishonest? I do not personally approve of abortion. You all know that. I've taken a considerable amount of heat for that personal belief, some of which has been laid on me by you good people. Fine. The Constitution allows us all to feel the way we choose. But the Constitution does not allow me not to enforce the law against people who blow up abortion clinics. I can sympathize with their overall point of view, but I cannot agree or sympathize with the use of violence to pursue a political position. We call that terrorism, and it's against the law. And I have sworn an oath to enforce the law fully and fairly in all cases, regardless of how I may or may not feel on a particular issue. Therefore, if you do not apply it even-handedly, ladies and gentlemen, it is not a principle at all, but ideology, and it is not very helpful to the way we govern our lives and our country. Now, on the broader question, you said that China has chosen its laws. Has it? Has it really? The People's Republic is not, unfortunately, a democratic country. It is a place where the laws are imposed by an elite few. Two courageous men died yesterday objecting to those laws, and in the successful attempt to save the life of an unborn child. Throughout history, men have given up their lives for worse causes than that. Those men are heroes by any definition. But I do not think anyone in this room, or for that matter anyone in our country, believes that they deserve to die, heroically or not. The penalty for civil disobedience is not supposed to be death. Even in the darkest days of the 1960s, when black Americans were working to secure their civil rights, the police in the southern states did not commit wholesale murder. And those local cops and members of the Ku Klux Klan who did step over that line were arrested and convicted by the FBI and the Justice Department. In short, there are fundamental differences between the People's Republic of China and America, and of the two systems, I much prefer ours. Ryan escaped the press room 10 minutes later to find Arnie standing at the top of the ramp.
Very good, Jack.
Oh? The president had learned to fear that tone of voice. Yeah, you just compared the People's Republic of China to Nazi Germany and the Ku Klux Klan. Arnie, why is it that the media feel such great solicitude for communist countries? They don't, and the hell they don't. I just compared the PRC to Nazi Germany, and they damn near wet their pants. Well, guess what? Mao murdered more people than Hitler did. That's public knowledge. I remember when CIA released the study that documented it. But they ignore it. Is some Chinese citizen killed by Mao less dead than some poor Polish bastard killed by Hitler? Jack, they have their sensibilities, Van Damme told his president. Yeah, well, just once in a while I wish they'd display something I can recognize as a principle. With that, Ryan strode back to his office, practically trailing smoke from his ears.
Temper, Jack, temper, Arnie said to no one in particular.
The president still had to learn the first principle of political life, the ability to treat a son of a bitch like your best friend, because the needs of your nation depended on it. The world would be a better place if it were as simple as Ryan wished, the chief of staff thought.
But it wasn't, and it showed no prospect of becoming so. A few blocks away at Foggy Bottom, Scott Adler had finished cringing and was making notes on how to mend the fences that his president had just kicked over. He'd have to sit down with Jack and go over a few things, like the principles he held so dear. "What did you think of that, Jerry?"
"Hosiah, I think we have a real president here. What does your son think of him?"
"Jerry, they've been friends for 20 years, back to when they both taught at the Naval Academy. I've met the man. He's a Catholic, but I think we can overlook that."
"We have to,"
Patterson almost laughed.
"So was one of the guys who got shot yesterday, remember?"
"Italian, too, probably drank a lot of wine."
"Well, Skip was known to have the occasional drink," Patterson told his black colleague.
"I didn't know," Reverend Jackson replied, disturbed at the thought.
"Hosiah, it is an imperfect world we live in."
"Just so he wasn't a dancer."
That was almost a joke, but not quite.
"Skip?
No, I've never known him to dance," Reverend Patterson assured his friend.
"By the way, I have an idea."
"What's that, Jerry?"
"How about this Sunday? You preach at my church, and I preach at yours. I'm sure we're both going to speak on the life and martyrdom of a Chinese man."
"And what passage will you base your sermon on?"
Hosiah asked, surprised and interested by the suggestion.
"Acts," Patterson replied at once.
Reverend Jackson considered that. It wasn't hard to guess the exact passage. Jerry was a fine biblical scholar.
"I admire your choice, sir."
"Thank you, Pastor Jackson.
What do you think of my other suggestion?"
Reverend Jackson hesitated only a few seconds.
"Reverend Patterson, I would be honored to preach at your church, and I gladly extend to you the invitation to preach at my own."
40 years earlier, when Jerry Patterson had been playing baseball in the church-sponsored Little League, Hosiah Jackson had been a young Baptist preacher. And the mere idea of preaching in Patterson's church could have incited a lynching. But, by the good Lord, they were men of God, and they were mourning the death, the martyrdom, of another man of God of yet another color. Before God, all men were equal, and that was the whole point of the faith they shared. Both men were thinking quickly of how they might have to alter their styles, because though both were Baptists, and though both preached the gospel of Jesus Christ to Baptist congregations, their communities were a little bit different and required slightly different approaches. But it was an accommodation both men could easily make.
"Thank you, Hosiah. You know, sometimes we have to acknowledge that our faith is bigger than we are."
For his part, Reverend Jackson was impressed. He never doubted the sincerity of his white colleague, and they'd chatted often on matters of religion and scripture. Hosiah would even admit, quietly, to himself, that Patterson was his superior as a scholar of the Holy Word, due to his somewhat lengthier formal education. But of the two, Hosiah Jackson was marginally the better speaker, and so their relative talents played well off each other.
"How about we get together for lunch and work out the details?" Jackson asked.
"Today?
I'm free."
"Sure. Where?"
"The country club? You're not a golfer, are you?"
Patterson asked hopefully.
He felt like a round, and his afternoon was free today for a change. "Never touched a golf club in my life, Jerry."
Hosiah had a good laugh at that.
"Robert is. Learned at Annapolis and been playing ever since. Says he kicks the president's backside every time they go out."
He'd never been to the Willow Glen Country Club either, and wondered if the club had any black members. Probably not. Mississippi hadn't changed quite that much yet, though Tiger Woods had played at a PGA tournament there, and so that color line had been breached at least.
"Well, he'd probably whip me too. Next time he comes down, maybe we can play around." Patterson's membership at Willow Glen was complimentary, another advantage to being pastor of a well-to-do congregation. And the truth of the matter was that, white or not, Jerry Patterson was not the least bit bigoted, Reverend Jackson knew. He preached the gospel with a pure heart. Hosea was old enough to remember when that had not been so, but that too had changed once and for all. Praise God. For Admiral Mancuso, the issues were the same, and a little different. An early riser, he'd caught CNN the same as everyone else. So had Brigadier General Mike Lahr. "Okay, Mike, what the hell is this all about?" SyncPac asked when his J2 arrived for his morning intel brief. "Admiral, it looks like a monumental clusterfuck. Those clergy stuck their noses in a tight crack and paid the price for it. More to the point, NCA is seriously pissed." NCA was the code acronym for National Command Authority, President Jack Ryan. "What do I need to know about this?" "Well, things are likely to heat up between America and China, for starters. The trade delegation we have in Beijing is probably going to catch some heat. If they catch too much, well..." His voice trailed off. "Give me worst case," SyncPac ordered. "Worst case, the PRC gets its collective back up and we recall the trade delegation and the ambassador, and things get real chilly for a while." "Then what?" "Then, well, that's more of a political question. But it wouldn't hurt for us to take it a little seriously, sir," Lahr told his boss, who took just about everything seriously. Mancuso looked at his wall map of the Pacific. Enterprise was back at sea doing exercises between Marcus Island and the Marianas. John Stennis was alongside in Pearl Harbor. Harry Truman was en route to Pearl Harbor after taking the long way around Cape Horn. Modern aircraft carriers are far too beamy for the Panama Canal. Lincoln was finishing up a bobtail refit in San Diego and about to go back to sea. Kitty Hawk and Independence, his two old, oil-fired carriers, were both in the Indian Ocean. At that, he was lucky. First and Seventh Fleets had six carriers fully operational for the first time in years. So, if he needed to project power, he had the assets to give people something to think about. He also had a lot of Air Force aircraft at his disposal. The 3rd Marine Division and the Army's 25th Light, based right there in Hawaii, wouldn't play in this picture. The Navy might bump heads with the Chi-Coms and the Air Force, but he lacked the amphibious assets to invade China. And besides, he wasn't insane enough to think that was a rational course of action under any circumstances. "What do we have in Taiwan right now?" "Mobile Bay, Milius, Chandler, and Fletcher are showing the flag. Frigates Curtis and Reed are doing operations with the ROC Navy. The submarines La Jolla, Helena, and Tennessee are trolling in the Formosa Strait or along the Chinese coast looking at their fleet units." Mancuso nodded. He usually kept some high-end SAM ships close to Taiwan. Milius was a Burke-class destroyer, and Mobile Bay was a cruiser, both of them with the Aegis system aboard to make the ROC feel a little better about the putative missile threat to their island. Mancuso didn't think the Chinese were foolish enough to launch an attack against a city with some U.S. Navy ships tied alongside, and the Aegis ships had a fair chance of stopping anything that flew their way. "But you never knew. And if this Beijing incident blew up any more..." He lifted the phone for SurfPac, the 3-star who administratively owned Pacific Fleet's surface ships. "Yeah?" answered Vice Admiral Ed Goldsmith. "Ed, Bart, what material shape are those ships we have in Taipei Harbor in?" "You're calling about the thing on CNN, right?"
"Correct," SyncPac confirmed.
"Pretty good. No material deficiencies I know about. They're doing the usual port visit routine, letting people aboard and all. Crews are spending a lot of time on the beach." Mancuso didn't have to ask what they were doing on the beach. He'd been a young sailor once, though never on Taiwan. "Might not hurt for them to keep their ears perked up some."
"Noted," SurfPac acknowledged. Mancuso didn't have to say more.
The ships would now stand alternating Condition 3 on their combat systems. The spy radars would be turned on aboard one of the Aegis ships at all times. One nice thing about Aegis ships was that they could go from half-sleep to fully operational in about 60 seconds. It was just a matter of turning some keys. They'd have to be a little careful. The spy radar put out enough power to fry electronic components for miles around. But it was just a matter of how you steered the electronic beams, and that was computer-controlled.
Okay, sir, I'll get the word out right now.
Thanks, Ed. I'll get you fully briefed in later today.
Aye, aye, Serf Pack replied.
He'd put a call to his squadron commanders immediately.
What else? Mancuso wondered.
We haven't heard anything directly from Washington, Admiral, B.G. Lahr told his boss.
Nice thing about being a sink, Mike. You're allowed to think on your own a little.
What a fucking mess, General Colonel Bondarenko observed to his drink. He wasn't talking about the news of the day, but about his command, even though the officers' club in Chibarsoville was comfortable. Russian general officers have always liked their comforts, and the building dated back to the Tsars. It had been built during the Russo-Japanese War at the beginning of the previous century and expanded several times. You could see the border between pre-revolution and post-revolution workmanship. Evidently, German POWs hadn't been trained this far east. They'd built most of the dachas for the party elite of the old days. But the vodka was fine, and the fellowship wasn't too bad either.
Things could be better, Comrade General, Bondarenko's operations officer agreed. But there is much that can be done the right way, and little bad to undo.
That was a gentle way of saying that the Far East Military District was less of a military command than it was a theoretical exercise. Of the five motor rifle divisions nominally under his command, only one, the 265th, was at 80% strength. The rest were at best regimental-size formations, or mere cadres. He also had theoretical command of a tank division, about a regiment and a half, plus 13 reserve divisions that existed not so much on paper as in some staff officers' dreams. The one thing he did have was huge equipment stores, but a lot of that equipment dated back to the 1960s or even earlier. The best troops in his area of command responsibility were not actually his to command. These were the border guards, battalion-sized formations once part of the KGB. Now a semi-independent armed service under the command of the Russian president. There was also a defense line of sorts, which dated back to the 1930s, and showed it. For this line, numerous tanks, some of them actually German in origin, were buried as bunkers. In fact, more than anything else, the line was reminiscent of the French Maginot Line, also a thing of the 1930s. It had been built to protect the Soviet Union against an attack by the Japanese, and then upgraded half-heartedly over the years to protect against the People's Republic of China. A defense never forgotten, but never fully remembered either. Bondarenko had toured parts of it the previous day. As far back as the Tsars, the engineering officers of the Russian army had never been fools. Some of the bunkers were sited with shrewd, even brilliant appreciation for the land. But the problem with bunkers was explained by a recent American aphorism. If you can see it, you can hit it. And if you can hit it, you can kill it. The line had been conceived and built when artillery fire had been a chancy thing, and an aircraft bomb was fortunate to hit the right county. Now you could use a 15-centimeter gun as accurately as a sniper rifle, and an aircraft could select which window pane to put the bomb through on a specific building.
Andrei Petrovich, I am pleased to hear your optimism. What is your first recommendation?
It will be simple to improve the camouflage on the border bunkers. That's been badly neglected over the years, Colonel Aliyev told his commander-in-chief. That will reduce their vulnerability considerably.
Allowing them to survive a serious attack for 60 minutes, Andrushka?
Maybe even 90, Comrade General. It's better than 5 minutes, is it not?
He paused for a sip of vodka. Both had been drinking for half an hour.
For the 265th, we must begin a serious training program at once. Honestly, the division commander did not impress me greatly, but I suppose we must give him a chance.
Bondarenko.
He's been out here so long, maybe he likes the idea of Chinese food.
General, I was out here as a lieutenant, Aliyev said. I remember the political officers telling us that the Chinese had increased the length of the bayonets on their AK-47s to get through the extra fat layer we'd grown after discarding true Marxism-Leninism and eating too much.
Really? Bondarenko asked.
That is the truth, Gennady Yosifovich.
So what do we know of the PLA?
There are a lot of them, and they've been training seriously for about 4 years now, much harder than we've been doing.
They can't afford to, Bondarenko observed sourly.
The other thing he'd learned on arriving was how thin the cupboard was for funds and training equipment. But it wasn't totally bleak. He had stores of consumable supplies that had been stocked and piled for 3 generations. There was a virtual mountain of shells for the 100-millimeter guns on his many, and long since obsolete, T-54-55 tanks, for example, and a sea of diesel fuel hidden away in underground tanks too numerous to count. The one thing he had in the Far East Military District was infrastructure, built up by the Soviet Union over generations of institutional paranoia. But that wasn't the same as an army to command.
What about aviation?
Mainly grounded, Aliyev answered glumly. Parts problems. We used up so many in Chechnya that there isn't enough to go around, and the Western District still has first call.
Oh, our political leadership expects the Poles to invade us?
That's the direction Germany is in, the G3 pointed out.
I've been fighting that out with the High Command for 3 years, Bondarenko growled, thinking of his time as chief of operations for the entire Russian army. People would rather listen to themselves than to others with the voice of reason.
He looked up at Aliyev.
And if the Chinese come?
The theater operations officer shrugged.
Then we have a problem.
Bondarenko remembered the maps. It wasn't all that far to the new gold strike, and the ever-industrious army engineers were building the damned roads to it.
Tomorrow, Andrei Petrovich. Tomorrow we start drawing up a training regimen for the whole command,
Sink Far East told his own G3. Chapter 27 Transportation. Diggs didn't entirely like what he saw, but it wasn't all that unexpected. A battalion of Colonel Lyle's 2nd Brigade was out there, maneuvering through the exercise area. Clumsily, Diggs thought. He had to amend his thoughts, of course. This wasn't the National Training Center at Fort Irwin, California, and Lyle's 2nd Brigade wasn't the 11th ACR, whose troopers were out there training practically every day, and as a result knew soldiering about as well as a surgeon knew cutting. No 1st Armored Division had turned into a garrison force since the demise of the Soviet Union, and all that wasted time in what was left of Yugoslavia trying to be peacekeepers hadn't sharpened their war-fighting skills.
That was a term Diggs hated.
Peacekeepers be damned, the general thought. They were supposed to be soldiers, not policemen in battle-dress uniform. The opposing force here was a German brigade, and by the looks of it a pretty good one, with their Leopard 2 tanks. Well, the Germans had soldiering in their genetic code somewhere. But they weren't any better trained than Americans, and training was the difference between some ignorant damn civilian and a soldier. Training meant knowing where to look and what to do when you saw something there. Training meant knowing what the tank to your left was going to do without having to look.
Training meant knowing how to fix your tank or Bradley when something broke. Training eventually meant pride, because with training came confidence. The sure knowledge that you were the baddest motherfucker in the Valley of the Shadow of Death and you didn't have to fear no evil at all. Colonel Boyle was flying the UH-60A in which Diggs was riding. Diggs was in the jump seat immediately aft and between the pilot seats. They were cruising about 500 feet over the ground.
"Oops, that platoon down there just walked into something," Boyle reported, pointing.
Sure enough, the lead tank's blinking yellow light started flashing the "I'm dead" signal.
"Let's see how the platoon sergeant recovers," General Diggs said.
They watched, and sure enough, the sergeant pulled the remaining three tanks back while the crew bailed out of the platoon leader's M1A2 main battle tank. As a practical matter, both it and its crew would probably have survived whatever administrative hit it had taken from the Germans. Nobody had yet come up with a weapon to punch reliably through the Chobham armor. But someone might someday, and so the tank crews were not encouraged to think themselves immortal and their tanks invulnerable.
"Okay, that sergeant knows his job," Diggs observed, as the helicopter moved to another venue.
The general saw that Colonel Masterman was making notes aplenty on his pad.
"What do you think, Duke?"
"I think they're at about 75% efficiency, sir," the G3 operations officer replied.
"Maybe a little better. We need to put everybody on the SimNet to shake 'em all up a little."
That was one of the Army's better investments. SimNet, the simulator network, comprised a warehouse full of M1 and Bradley simulators, linked by supercomputer and satellite with two additional such warehouses, so that highly complex and realistic battles could be fought out electronically. It had been hugely expensive, and while it could never fully simulate training in the field, it was nevertheless a training aid without parallel.
"General, all that time in Yugoslavia didn't help Lyle's boys," Boyle said from the chopper's right seat.
"I know that," Diggs agreed. "I'm not going to kill anybody's career just yet," he promised.
Boyle's head turned to grin.
"Good, sir. I'll spread that word around."
"What do you think of the Germans?"
"I know their boss, General Major Siegfried Model. He's damn smart. Plays a hell of a game of cards. Be warned, General."
"Is that a fact?"
Diggs had commanded the NTC until quite recently, and had occasionally tried his luck at Las Vegas, a mere 2 hours up I-15 from the post.
"Sir, I know what you're thinking." "Think again," Boyle cautioned his boss.
"Your helicopters seem to be doing well."
"Yep, Yugoslavia was fairly decent training for us. And long as we have gas, I can train my people."
"What about live fire?" the commanding general of First Tanks asked.
"We haven't done that in a while, sir, but again the simulators are almost as good as the real thing," Boyle replied over the intercom. "But I think you'll want your track toads to get some in, General."
And Boyle was right on that one. Nothing substituted for live fire in an Abrams or a Bradley. The stakeout on the park bench turned out to be lengthy and boring. First of all, of course, they'd pulled the container, opened it, and discovered that the contents were two sheets of paper, closely printed with Cyrillic characters, but encrypted. So the sheet had been photographed and sent off to the Crippies for decryption. This had not proven to be easy. In fact, it had thus far proven to be impossible, leading the officers from the Federal Security Service to conclude that the Chinese, if that was who it was, had adopted the old KGB practice of using one-time pads. These were unbreakable in theoretical terms because there was no pattern, formula, or algorithm to crack. The rest of the time was just a matter of waiting to see who came to pick up the package. It ended up taking days. The FSS put three cars on the case. Two of them were vans with long-lens cameras on the target. In the meanwhile, Suvorov/Konyev's apartment was as closely watched as the Moscow Stock Exchange ticker.
The subject himself had a permanent shadow of up to 10 trained officers, mainly KGB-trained spy chasers instead of Provolov's homicide investigators, but with a leavening of the latter because it was technically still their case. It would remain a homicide case until some foreign national, they hoped, picked up the package under the bench. Since it was a park bench, people sat on it regularly. Adults reading papers, children reading comic books, teenagers holding hands, people chatting amiably. Even two elderly men who met every afternoon for a game of chess played on a small magnetic board. After every such visit, the stash was checked for movement or disturbance, always without result. By the fourth day, people speculated aloud that it was all some sort of trick. This was Suvorov / Konyev's way of seeing if he were being trailed or not. If so, he was a clever son of a bitch, the surveillance people all agreed. But they already knew that. The break came in the late afternoon of day five, and it was the man they wanted it to be. His name was Kong Deshi, and he was a minor diplomat on the official list, age 46, a man of modest dimensions, and, the form card at the foreign ministry said, modest intellectual gifts. That was a polite way of saying he was considered a dunce. But, as others had noted, that was the perfect cover for a spy, and one which wasted a lot of time for counterintelligence people, making them trail dumb diplomats all over the world who turned out to be nothing more than just that, dumb diplomats, of which the global supply was ample. The man was walking casually with another Chinese national, who was a businessman of some sort, or so they'd thought. Sitting, they'd continued to chat, gesturing around until the second man had turned to look at something Kong had pointed at. Then Kong's right hand had slipped rapidly and almost invisibly under the bench and retrieved the stash, possibly replacing it with another before his hand went back in his lap. 5 minutes later, after a smoke, they'd both walked off, back in the direction of the nearest metro station.
"Patience," the head FSS officer had told his people over the radio circuit.
And so they'd waited over an hour, until they were certain that there were no parked cars about, keeping an eye on the dead drop. Only then had an FSS man walked to the bench, sat down with his afternoon paper, and pulled the package. The way he flicked his cigarette away told the rest of the team that there had been a substitution. In the laboratory, it was immediately discovered that the package had a key lock, and that got everyone's attention. The package was X-rayed immediately and found to contain a battery and some wires, plus a semi-opaque rectangle that collectively represented a pyrotechnic device. Whatever was inside the package was therefore valuable. A skilled locksmith took 20 minutes picking the lock, and then the holder was opened to reveal a few sheets of flash paper. These were removed and photographed to show a solid collection of Cyrillic letters, and they were all random. It was a one-time pad key sheet, the best thing they could have hoped to find. The sheets were refolded exactly as they had been replaced in the holder, and then the thin metal container, it looked like a cheap cigarette case, was returned to the bench.
"So?" Provolov asked the Federal Security Service officer on the case.
"So, the next time our subject sends a message, we'll be able to read it."
"And then we'll know," Provolov went on.
"Perhaps. We'll know something more than we know now. We'll have proof that this Suvorov fellow is a spy. That I can promise you," the counterintelligence officer pronounced. Provolov had to admit to himself that they were no closer to solving his murder case than they'd been 2 weeks before. But at least things were moving, even if the path merely led them deeper into the fog.
"So, Mike?" Dan Murray asked, 8 time zones away.
"No nibbles yet, Director, but now it looks like we're chasing a spook. The subject's name is Klementy Ivanich Suvorov, currently living as Ivan Yuryevich Konyev.
Riley read off the address. The trail leads to him, or at least it seems to, and we spotted him making probable contact with a Chinese diplomat. And what the hell does all this mean? FBI Director Murray wondered aloud into the secure phone. You got me there, Director, but it sure has turned into an interesting case. You must be pretty tight with this Provolov guy. He's a good cop, and yes, sir, we get along just fine. That was more than Cliff Rutledge could say about his relationship with Shen Tang. Your news coverage of this incident was bad enough, but your president's remarks on our domestic policy is a violation of Chinese sovereignty, the Chinese foreign minister said almost in a shout, for the seventh time since lunch. Minister, Cliff Rutledge replied, none of this would have happened but for your policeman shooting an accredited diplomat, and that is not, strictly speaking, an entirely civilized act. Our internal affairs are our internal affairs, Shen retorted at once. That is so, Minister. But America has her own beliefs, and if you ask us to honor yours, then we may request that you show some respect for ours. We grow weary of America's interference with Chinese internal affairs. First you recognize our rebellious province on Taiwan. Then you encourage foreigners to interfere with our internal policies. Then you send a spy under the cover of religious beliefs to violate our laws with a diplomat from yet another country. Then you photograph a Chinese policeman doing his duty. And then your president condemns us for your interference with our internal affairs. The People's Republic will not tolerate this uncivilized activity. And now you're going to demand most favored nation trade status, eh? Mark Gant thought in his chair. Damn, this was like a meeting with investment bankers. The pirate kind. On Wall Street.
Minister, you call us uncivilized, Rutledge replied. But there is no blood on our hands. Now we are here, as I recall, to discuss trade issues. Can we return to that agenda?
Mr. Rutledge, America does not have the right to dictate to the People's Republic on one hand, and to deny us our rights on the other, Shen retorted.
Minister, America has made no such intrusion on China's internal affairs. If you kill a diplomat, you must expect a reaction. On the question of the Republic of China...
There is no Republic of China!
The PRC's foreign minister nearly screamed.
They are a renegade province, and you have violated our sovereignty by recognizing them!
Minister, the Republic of China is an independent nation with a freely elected government, and we are not the only country to recognize this fact. It is the policy of the United States of America to encourage the self-determination of peoples. At such time as the people in the ROC elect to become part of the mainland, that is their choice. But since they have freely chosen to be what they are, America chooses to recognize them. As we expect others to recognize America as a legitimate government because it represents the will of her people, so it is incumbent upon America to recognize the will of other peoples. Rutledge sat back in his chair, evidently bored with the course the afternoon had taken. The morning he'd expected. The PRC had to blow off some steam, but one morning was enough for that. This was getting tiresome.
And if another of our provinces rebels? Will you recognize that?
Is the minister telling me of further political unrest in the People's Republic? Rutledge inquired at once. A little too fast and too glibly, he told himself a moment later. In any case, I have no instructions for that eventuality. It was supposed to have been a semi-humorous response to rather a dumb question. But Minister Shen evidently didn't have his sense of humor turned on today. His hand came up, finger extended, and now he shook it at Cliff Rutledge and the United States.
You cheat us. You interfere with us. You insult us. You blame us for the inefficiency of your economy. You deny us fair access to your markets. And you sit there as though you are the seat of the world's virtue. We will have none of this.
Minister, we have opened our doors to trade with your country. And you have closed your door in our face.
"It is your door to open or close," he conceded. "But we have our doors to close as well, if you so force us. We have no wish to do this. We wish for fair and free trade between the great Chinese people and the American people. But the impediments to that trade are not to be found in America."
"You insult us, and then you expect us to invite you into our home?"
"Minister, America insults no one. A tragedy happened in the People's Republic yesterday. It was probably something you would have preferred to avoid, but even so it happened. The President of the United States has asked for you to investigate the incident. That is not an unreasonable request. What do you condemn us for? A journalist reported the facts. Does China deny the facts we saw on television? Do you claim that a private American company fabricated this event? I think not. Do you say that those two men are not dead? Regrettably, this is not the case. Do you say that your policeman was justified in killing an accredited diplomat and a clergyman holding a newborn child? Rutledge asked in his most reasonable voice. Minister, all you have said for the past 3.5 hours is that America is wrong for objecting to what appears to be cold-blooded murder. And our objection was merely a request for your government to investigate the incident. Minister, America has neither done nor said anything unreasonable, and we grow weary of the accusation. My delegation and I came here to discuss trade. We would like the People's Republic to open up its markets more, so that trade can become trade. The free exchange of goods across international borders. You request a most favored nation trading relationship with the United States. That will not happen until such time as your markets are as open to America as America's are open to China. But it can happen at such time as you make the changes we require. The People's Republic is finished with acceding to America's insulting demands. We are finished with tolerating your insults to our sovereignty. We are finished with your interference in our internal affairs. It is time for America to consider our reasonable requests. China desires to have a fair trading relationship with the United States. We ask no more than what you give other nations. Most favored nation.
Minister, that will not happen until such time as you open your markets to our goods. Trade is not free if it is not fair. We object also to the PRC's violation of copyright and trademark treaties and agreements. We object to having industries fully owned by agencies of the government of the People's Republic to violate patent treaties, even to the point of manufacturing proprietary American products without permission or compensation, and...
So now you call us thieves? Shen demanded.
Minister, I point out that such words have not escaped my lips. It is a fact, however, that we have examples of products made in China by factories owned by agencies of your government, which products appear to contain American inventions for which the inventors have not been compensated, and from whom permission to manufacture the copies has not been obtained. I can show you examples of those products if you wish. Shen's reaction was an angry wave of the hand, which Rutledge took to mean, "No, thank you," or something like that.
I have no interest in seeing physical evidence of American lies and distortions.
Gant just sat back in his chair while Rutledge made his injured reply, like a spectator at a prize fight, wondering if anyone would land the knockdown punch. Probably not, he thought. Neither had a glass chin, and both were too light on their feet. What resulted was a lot of flailing about, but no serious result. It was just a new kind of boring for him, exciting in its form, but dull in its result. He made some notes, but those were merely memory aids to help him remember how this had gone. It might make a fun chapter in his autobiography. What title, he wondered? Trader and diplomat, maybe? 45 minutes later it broke up, with the usual handshakes, as cordial as the meeting had been contentious, which rather amazed Mark Gant.
"It's all business, not personal," Rutledge explained. "I'm surprised they're dwelling on this so much.
It's not as though we've actually accused them of anything.
Hell, even the president just asked for an investigation.
Why are they so touchy? He wondered aloud.
Maybe they're worried they won't get what they want out of the talks, Gant speculated.
But why are they that worried? Rutledge asked.
Maybe their foreign exchange reserves are even lower than my computer model suggests, Gant shrugged.
But even if they are, they're not exactly following a course that would ameliorate it.
Rutledge slammed his hands together in frustration.
They're not behaving logically.
Okay, sure, they're allowed to have a conniption fit over this shooting thing, and yeah, maybe President Ryan pushed it a little too far, saying some of the things he said. And Christ knows he's a real Neanderthal on the abortion issue. But all of that does not justify the time and the passion in their position.
Fear? Gant wondered.
Fear of what?
If their cash reserves are that low, or maybe even lower, then they could be in a tight crack, Cliff.
Tighter than we appreciate.
Assume that they are, Mark. What makes it something to be fearful about?
A couple of things, Gant said, leaning forward in his limo seat. It means they don't have the cash to buy things, or to meet the payments on the things they've already bought. It's an embarrassment, and, like you said, these are proud people. I don't see them admitting they're wrong or wanting to show weakness.
That's a fact, Rutledge agreed.
Pride can get people into a lot of trouble, Cliff, Gant thought aloud. He remembered a fund on Wall Street that had taken $100 million hit because its managing director wouldn't back off a position that he'd thought was correct a few days earlier, but then stayed with it after it was manifestly clear that he was wrong.
Why?
Because he hadn't wanted to look like a pussy on the street. And so instead of appearing to be a pussy, he'd proclaimed to the whole world that he was an ass.
But how did one translate that into foreign affairs?
A chief of state was smarter than that, wasn't he?
It's not going well, my friend, Zhang told Fang. That foolish policeman is to blame. Yes, the Americans were wrong to react so strongly, but that would not have taken place at all if not for the overzealous police officer.
President Ryan, why does he hate us so?
Zhang, twice you have plotted against the Russians, and twice you've played your intrigue against America. Is it not possible that the Americans know of this? Is it not possible that they guessed it was the case? Has it not occurred to you that this is why they recognize the Taiwan regime?
Zhang Hansan shook his head.
This is not possible. Nothing was ever written down.
And our security was perfect in both cases. He didn't trouble himself to add.
When things are said around people with ears, Zhang, they remember them. There are few secrets in the world. You can no more keep the affairs of state secret than you can conceal the sunrise, Fang went on, thinking that he'd make sure that this phrase went into the record of the talk that Ming would write up for him.
They spread too far. They reach too many people, and each of them has a mouth.
Then what would you have us do?
The American has requested an investigation, so we give him one. The facts we discover will be whatever facts we wish them to be. If a policeman must die, there are many others to take his place. Our trading relationship with America is more important than this trivial matter, Zhang.
We cannot afford to abase ourselves before the barbarian.
We cannot afford not to in this case. We cannot allow false pride to put the country at risk.
Fang sighed. His friend Zhang had always been a proud one. A man able to see far, certainly, but too aware of himself and the place he wanted. Yet the one he'd chosen was difficult. He'd never wanted the first place for himself, but instead to be the man who influenced the man at the top. To be like the court eunuchs who had directed the various emperors for over 1,000 years.
Fang almost smiled, thinking that no amount of power was worth becoming a eunuch, at the royal court or not, and that Zhang probably didn't wish to go that far either.
but to be the man of power behind the curtain was probably more difficult than to be the man in the first chair. And yet Fang remembered Zhang had been the prime mover behind Xu's election to general secretary. Xu was an intellectual nonentity, a pleasant enough man with regal looks, able to speak in public well, but not himself a man of great ideas. And that explained things, didn't it? Zhang had helped make Xu the chief of the Politburo precisely because he was an empty vessel, and Zhang was the one to fill the void of ideas with his own thoughts. Of course. He ought to have seen it sooner. Elsewhere it was believed that Xu had been chosen for his middle-of-the-road stance on everything. A conciliator, a consensus-maker, they called him outside the PRC. In fact, he was a man of few convictions, able to adopt those of anyone else, if that someone, Zhang, looked about first and decided where the Politburo should go. Xu was not a complete puppet, of course. That was the problem with people. However useful they might be on some issues, on others they held to the illusion that they thought for themselves. And the most foolish of them did have ideas. And those ideas were rarely logical and almost never helpful. Xu had embarrassed Zhang on more than one occasion. And since he was chairman of the Politburo, Xu did have real personal power. Just not the wit to make proper use of it. But what, 60% of the time, maybe a little more? He was merely Zhang's mouthpiece. And Zhang, for his part, was largely free to exert his own influence and to make his own national policy. He did so mostly unseen and unknown outside the Politburo itself, and not entirely known inside either, since so many of his meetings with Xu were private, and most of the time Zhang never spoke of them even to Fang. His old friend was a chameleon, Fang thought, hardly for the first time. But if he showed humility in not seeking prominence to match his influence, then he balanced that with the fault of pride, and worse, he didn't seem to know what weakness he displayed. He thought either that it wasn't a fault at all, or that only he knew of it. All men had their weaknesses, and the greatest of these were invariably those unknown to their practitioners. Fang checked his watch and took his leave. With luck, he'd be home at a decent hour, after he transcribed his notes through Ming. What a novelty, getting home on time. Chapter 28 Collision Courses. Those sons of bitches, Vice President Jackson observed with his coffee. Welcome to the wonderful world of statecraft, Robbie, Ryan told his friend. It was 7:45 a.m. in the Oval Office. Kathy and the kids had gotten off early, and the day was starting fast. We've had our suspicions, but here's the proof, if you want to call it that. The war with Japan and that little problem we had with Iran started in Beijing. Well, not exactly, but this Zhang guy, acting for Xu, it would seem, aided and abetted both. Well, he may be a nasty son of a bitch, but I wouldn't give him points for brains, Robbie said, after a moment's reflection. Then he thought some more. But maybe that's not fair. From his point of view, the plans were pretty clever, using others to be his stalking horse. He risked nothing himself, then he figured to move in and profit on the risks of others. It certainly looked efficient, I suppose. Question is, what's his next move? Between this and what Rutledge reports from Beijing, I'd say we have to take these people a little seriously, Robbie reflected. Then his head perked up some more. Jack, we have to get more people in on this. Mary Pat will flip out if we even suggest it, Ryan told him. Too damn bad. Jack, it's the old problem with intelligence information. If you spread it out too much, you risk compromising it, and then you lose it. But if you don't use it at all, you might as well not even have it. Where do you draw the line? It was a rhetorical question. If you err on the side of safety, but the safety of the country, not the source. There's a real live person on the other end of this sheet of paper, Rob, Jack pointed out.
I'm sure there is. But there are 250 million people outside this room, Jack, and the oath we both swore was to them, not some Chinese puke in Beijing. What this tells us is that the guy making policy in China is willing to start wars, and twice now we've sent our people to fight wars he's had a part in starting. Jesus, man, war is supposed to be a thing of the past, but this Zhang guy hasn't figured that one out yet. What's he doing that we don't know about?
Well, that's what Zorga's all about, Rob. The idea is that we find out beforehand and have a chance to forestall it.
Jackson nodded.
Maybe so, but once upon a time there was a source called magic that told us a lot about an enemy's intentions. But when that enemy launched the first attack, we were asleep. Because magic was so important, we never told Sink Pack about it, and he ended up not preparing for Pearl Harbor. I know intel's important, but it has its operational limitations. All this really tells us is that we have a potential adversary with little in the way of inhibitions. We know his mindset, but not his intentions or current operations. Moreover, Sorge is giving us recollections of private conversations between one guy who makes policy and another guy who tries to influence policy. A lot of stuff is being left out. This looks like a cover-your-ass diary, doesn't it?
Ryan told himself that this was a particularly smart critique. Like the people at Langley, he'd allowed himself to wax a little too euphoric about a source they'd never even approached before. Songbird was good, but not without limitations. Big ones.
Yeah, Rob, that's probably just what it is. This Fang guy probably keeps the diary just to have something to pull out of the drawer if one of his colleagues on the Chinese Politburo tries to buttfuck him.
So it isn't Sir Thomas More whose words we're reading, Tomcat observed.
Not hardly, Ryan conceded, but it's a good source. All the people who've looked at this for us say it feels very real.
I'm not saying it isn't true, Jack. I'm saying it isn't all, the Vice President persisted.
Message received, Admiral.
Ryan held up his hands in surrender.
What do you recommend?
SecDef for starters, and the Chiefs, and J3 and J5, and probably Sink Pack.
Your boy Bart Mancuso, Jackson added, with a hint of distaste.
Why don't you like the guy? Swordsman asked.
He's a bubblehead, the career fighter pilot answered. Submariners don't get around all that much. But I grant you he's a pretty good operator.
The submarine operation he'd run on the Japs using old boomers had been pretty swift, Jackson admitted to himself.
Specific recommendations?
Rutledge tells us that the Chi-Coms are talking like they're real torqued over the Taiwan thing. What if they act on that? Like a missile strike into the island. Christ knows they have enough missiles to toss, and we have ships in harbor there all the time.
You really think they'd be dumb enough to launch an attack on a city with one of our ships tied alongside? Ryan asked.
Nasty or not, this Zhang guy wasn't going to risk war with America quite that foolishly, was he?
What if they don't know the ship's there? What if they get bad intel? Jack, the shooters don't always get good data from the guys in the back room. Trust me. Been there, done that, got the fucking scars, you know.
And the ships can take care of themselves, can't they?
Not if they don't have all their systems turned on.
And can a Navy SAM stop a ballistic inbound? Robbie wondered aloud.
I don't know. How about we have Tony Britano check it out for us?
Okay, give him a call. Ryan paused.
Robbie, I have somebody coming in a few minutes. We need to talk some more about this.
With Adler and Britano, the President added.
Tony's very good on hardware and management stuff, but he needs a little educating on operations.
So, educate him, Ryan told Jackson.
Aye, aye, sir.
The Vice President headed out the door. They got the container back to its magnetic home less than 2 hours after removing it, thanking God, Russians were allowed to do that now, that the lock mechanism wasn't one of the new electronic ones. Those could be very difficult to break. But the problem with all such security measures was that they all too often ran the chance